joined now by Jeff Woods. Jeff, how you doing?
Great, Mr. Greger. How are you?
I am. I'm doing very well. I know that the weather's getting a little bit warm. Everybody's getting a little antsy. We're starting to come out of hibernation, and after this weekend's cold snap, it's supposed to be warm, and we're into March, and then everybody starts thinking of doing more things like running. Golf guys get out there and they're firing balls all over the place. I want to talk about maybe the preseason train factor. If you're hitting the links or starting to go for that run, so people don't avoid having those aches and pains and being stiff and sore and screwing up their shoulders.
Well, you know what, Jason? It's a great time of year to get into it, as far as the preseason training, I mean. So the benefit, first of all, it's going to reduce any risk of injury or illness. Your season can be over before it starts. So if you do end up with an injury, it affects your job, your ability to kind of commit to your team if you're playing softball or whatever you're doing for the summer. But then beyond that, if you get into the preseason training, it allows you to participate pain-free, and it also is going to improve your performance. So for anybody who has an improved performance factor, as a professional trainer, we look at trying to keep people committed long-term to exercise. So there's a great deal of satisfaction when you can perform well.
How much time then do you think you need to properly preseason train?
Well, it might be a little bit different. Just talking about a professional hockey player or a professional athlete in general, they may be able to go through a period of training that lasts for maybe 4 weeks and have adaptations take place. Now, for the average person, they might need about 6 weeks of effective training for adaptations to take place where they could expect some improvements in their performance and reduce the risk of injury. Now, again, going back to looking at this 6-week timeline, thinking the 1st of March, middle of April in Edmonton, most of the golf courses are open, the outdoor tennis courts and basketball areas where you can do things outside, that kind of happens the middle of April. So the timing is perfect to get started. So here's another thing. You'll find this kind of interesting. Gardening, kind of a sedentary activity, but there's a lot of people that participate, getting their gardens in order and doing things around the house. Those people as well, with lifting, wheelbarrowing, shoveling, that sort of thing, really prone to back injury. So those people would benefit from some sort of preseason training as well, not just the athletes.
Jeff Woods joined us. So then the general guidelines, because I know everybody's different, in setting up one of these 6-week plans that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's a couple. I've got 6 quick points that everybody should kind of take into account when they're going to set up their training. The first thing you want to try and define, Jason, is what energy pathway am I going to use in my sport or activity? Is it like aerobic activity, like running a marathon or a half marathon? Is it continuous output of energy? Or is it anaerobic, something like sprint running, where it's a more maximal effort and the athlete's taxed within 10 seconds? So, for example, tennis, baseball, golf, basketball, soccer, those are all anaerobic activities. And everything that most people are going to participate in, they're typically anaerobic type sports. So with that in mind, the best type of training that person could do would be some form of interval training. Okay? So, and if you're unclear about how to execute interval training, talk to your trainer, talk to somebody at the gym that can give you some insight on setting up a nice interval program of some sort. The second thing, define your strength and power needs. In most cases, people need to be strong using some sort of weight load, doing some sort of full body type training where they fail between 8 and 12 repetitions with load. Again, for the average person, that's going to be enough. And the kind of movements they should probably do, big multi-joint movements that integrate the whole body to work at one time. Okay? The third thing they should take into account, define the biomechanical patterns of your sport or activity. And I'll use golf as an example. There's lots of rotation in golf.
Yeah.
So those people should look at some form of resistance that forces a nice dynamic rotation in their workout.
Like bands?
Yeah, bands would work fine, Jason. Weights would work fine. Like using a medicine ball or something like that.
Okay.
It's certainly fine. And just, again, try to duplicate the movements of whatever sport you take part in. Number 4, reduce the amount of fixed or stationary equipment you rely on in your strength training program. So all I mean by that, try to deviate from, you know, big pieces of heavy equipment that are anchored to the ground, because you don't have any of that stuff to rely on when you're out playing golf or when you're out playing tennis. You know, and just the things, too, like in your day-to-day life, doing tasks, you have to integrate your body to work and balance without the aid of a machine. So, again, using the medicine balls, big bars, it's called loaded movement training, and that more specifically prepares you for the movement of life or sport. The fifth thing, reduce the amount of time you spend on a lot of static stretching. And I'm saying, you know, not, I want you to stretch, but I just don't want people to waste a lot of time on that. I want you to have more efficient use of time and just sort of minimize the amount of static stretching. And again, more movement mimicking your sport or activity. And number six, just don't stop your strength training after your season starts. I want you to continue, just reduce the frequency. But if you continue to weight train through your playing season, again, you just reduce the risk of injury. And just that's the way that you should go, just for safety's sake.
Reducing time for static stretching, Jeff. Now, obviously, you never do static stretching before exercise, and everything's changed. That's how people used to think, and there's a lot of studies saying that that's not the best thing to do now. But you do it after you work out. So, like, is a 5 minute, is a 10 minute? Does it vary from person to person? Like, what's a good amount of time where you're going to get something out of it, but not to the point where you're wasting time?
Well, I would say this. If you are going to do a little bit of static stretching, even if it is before activity, it's the time that you hold each stretch that is the critical factor. In that 10 to 30 second range, holding a stretch, no problem. Post-exercise, you know, you again, to spend some time. Again, but the science says, Jason, I mean, for anybody doing static stretching with the intention to relieve delayed onset muscle soreness, the science says that it doesn't really improve or reduce any probability of soreness.
Okay.
You're better off just to sort of engage in some form of mild activity, and frankly, just spend more time at the front end of your workouts, just doing a slow, steady, methodical warm-up, doing some sort of controlled dynamic movement over the static stretch, quite frankly, at the front end.
Okay. Jeff, a few texts coming in here quickly. Is there any correlation between increased metabolism for active individuals and change in season, winter, and summer, and is it isolated to certain body types?
Well, okay, so I just want to be clear then. So are you talking about just being metabolically more efficient in the wintertime and
yes.
cold climates?
Yeah.
There is some research that speaks to that, because your body, you shiver when you're cold, and there's an energy cost associated with that. Now, I've only looked at one study, but it does sort of present a picture that there might be some value in that.
Hmm.
Now, here's the other side, though. When it is excessively cold, there is an inhibiting factor for people to actually get out and exercise. So there might be some trade-offs as well because of the cold temperatures, obviously.
Yeah. So if you can convince yourself to go out in minus 15 and do some exercise compared to plus 20, there could be a small benefit just because of the temperature change?
There could be, yes, because your body metabolically is trying to warm itself. So there's an energy cost metabolically trying to stay warm. And again, I bring up this shivering factor. That was the specific thing cited in the study.
Okay. That's pretty interesting.
It is. There's always, you know, Jason, tons of research on exercise science. And for any of your listeners that are on Twitter, there are some, if you just even key in the word science, you'll find some great, great people to follow that sort of speak to a lot of this research on Twitter.
One quick one going to golf, because we've got a lot of listeners who are golf people, and, you know, they're always looking to improve their game, so they take the lessons. But I know the one thing, because a lot of people are inactive, and they don't go and swing very often. In the, you know, they're not doing stuff, and maybe you're doing some weights and squats, which is still great, but you're not emulating that swing pattern or anything. And that a lot of guys seems that's where you get, you know, rotator cuff soreness and anything specific for golf. Jeff, what do you recommend as far as a warm-up before you even hit the driving range? What's a must-have for all of our golfers?
Well, okay, so you're talking specifically then, Jason, at the golf course just before you're about to start to hit balls?
Yeah.
Well, a couple of things. I would recommend this. Just instead of swinging two clubs at a time, and I see this frequently, guys will load up two clubs in their hand and they start to swing.
Yeah.
Which is a bad thing, and I'll tell you why. Because it starts to force slow twitch muscle fiber to react. So in term, and you want to be more reactive to impact the ball. So there would be more value in just swinging through a nice controlled range of motion using one club only. Okay? Now, this research comes from a study I looked at for baseball players. Because the baseball players on the on-deck circle waiting to go up would typically put a weighted donut on their bat, or yep. they would swing two bats. So they actually tested the baseball players after they had been swinging the weighted baseball bat, and their timing was dramatically off. So the same sort of theory applies for golf. It actually inhibits your swing speed. So you don't want to do anything that's going to inhibit swing speed, because that, in fact, will slow down your club head, and it equates to less distance.
So it activates the slow twitch muscles, which is what you don't want, and then it inhibits your swing speed?
Correct. That is absolutely correct.
That is a great tip. I guarantee every guy, I've done that. Idiot. So then what? So if you don't want to do, you should just be using one, but you should be doing stuff before you swing the club, like just rotation trunks, like put the club over your shoulders or in front of you, like you're going to do a front squat, but don't squat and just do twists. Or what do you do to try to get some motion?
Now, okay, that's a good idea too. So now let's go back just to something that is going to warm you up and just dynamically stretch all of your muscles from head to toe. So you hit it right on the head. Take your driver, the longest club in your bag, put that up over top of your head, okay? Extend your elbows. Fully straight are the elbows. And then take a good athletic posture with your hands up over your head with that club. Try and do squats. Do 5 or 6 squats, rest for 30 seconds, and repeat. There would be more benefit in doing that than, you know, swinging, you know, two clubs, only because it forces, again, this dynamic flexibility pattern from head to toe, because all of the muscles are integrated, they work together. So that would be the first movement to do. And then still with that club overhead, your second series of dynamic stretching would be just to turn from side to side with that club over your head and your elbows fully extended.
Jeff, outstanding stuff, man. No, that's great. I appreciate it. All the golfers are loving that.
Well, and I know it's very hard to get an image when we're on the radio, but if people need more information, they can contact me on Twitter. Happy to give it out.
Okay, man. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jason.